Welcome to All Write in Sin City, a podcast about writers and writing in the Windsor, Detroit region. Your podcasters today are
Irene Moore Davis, author, educator, and local historian.
Sarah Jarvis, former bookseller, publishing rep, and literary festival chair.
And me, Kim Conklin, Windsor-based writer and filmmaker.
Chika Unigwe was born in Enugu, Nigeria. She was educated at the University of Nigeria in Nsukka and the Catholic University of Leuven prior to earning her PhD from Leiden University in the Netherlands. She now lives in the United States and teaches at Georgia College in Milledgeville, Georgia. Her work has been widely translated and has won multiple awards. Unigwe's previous publications include the poetry collections Teardrops and Born in Nigeria, novels The Phoenix on Black Sisters Street, Night Dancer and the Black Messiah, and the short story collection Better Never Than Late, along with numerous other short stories, essays, and works of journalism. She has been widely anthologized and has published works in the New York Times, Guernica, Kenyon Review, the UK Guardian, Wasafiri, and Transition. And Chika Unigwe's highly anticipated new novel, The Middle Daughter, will be released by Dzank Books in April 2023. Welcome, Chika Unigwe.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
When and how did you first fall in love with writing?
Geez, that's sort of difficult to remember. I've always enjoyed reading. And I think that my love for reading and my love for writing are sort of intertwined. But if I had to put like some timeline on it, it would be being in probably second grade and having a classmate whose mother was a writer. And her mother is the first African woman to be published in English, like her novel came out a long time ago. I want to say 1968, her first novel came out. And by the time I was in elementary school, she sort of moved into writing children's books as well. She had her own publishing house. And I remember her coming to school one day and our teacher, for some reason, wasn't in the classroom. Maybe she had come in for a meeting with our teacher, but she had all these books that she'd written that she sort of handed out to us. To keep us busy while she talks to our teacher. And I just fell in love with her and I wanted to be her and I wanted to be like her.
And who was that author and publisher?
Yeah, so her name is Flora Mwapa. So she published Efuru, I think 1968, which was the first novel by an African woman to be published in the UK, and it was published by Heinemann African Press.
Impressive.
Mm-hmm. Have there been other authors that have influenced your writing since then, do you think?
I mean, absolutely. I read a lot. And even while I was reading my past children's stories, I mean, growing up middle class in Nigeria, you had access to books, but you also had access to a lot of books from the West. So I read a lot of Enid Blyton books, The Famous Five, Mr. Noddy. And then just sort of transitioned from there into whatever my older siblings were reading. So I'm the sixth of seven children. There was a time when one of my older sisters was really into Mills and Boons. So I read all of her Mills and Boons collections. And then my brothers were into Sidney Sheldon and James Hadley Chase. So I read all of those two. And I think that everything that I've read and I have liked, I think that they've somehow made it into my writing, whether consciously or unconsciously. I read a lot of short stories. I love Alice Munro's short stories. I think I've read everything by Alice Munro. And when I'm writing and I get into some sort of funk, I go back to Alice Munro. I've read everything by Bernardine Evaristo. I love everything she's written. And then maybe middle school here, probably middle school, I discovered a Nigerian writer called Buchi Emecheta, who was living in the UK and writing semi-autobiographical novels about, you know, being a single woman, mother of, being a single parent, mother of five children, living in the UK and writing books. Again, like Mwapa, she just floored me. I was, you know, very impressed with her. So she's also been one of my huge inspirations. And anytime I think that, oh no, I can't do this, I just think of Flora Mwapa living in the UK, going to, I think at some point she was in school, you know, raising five children and still managing to write and be successful at it.
You've lived in many different places, Nigeria, Belgium, and most recently the United States. Mm-hmm. What impact has living in all these different geographies and cultures had on your first your perspective and then also on your writing?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I don't think of Nigeria as living in Nigeria. I mean, I'm Nigerian. It's my home. So, and then I lived in Belgium for 19 years because I met a Belgian man in college and, you know, he wanted to come home. I came back with him. Many years later, we're still together, and we moved to the States, honestly, about 10 years ago. But everywhere that I have lived has influenced the writing in some way because I'm getting new experiences. I think as what a writer does is really to observe and then to refract, you know, in writing that observation, which is why in my most recent work, Atlanta sort of comes into it, right? Whereas in my previous works, there's a lot of Nigeria, a lot of Belgium. And now for the first time, I have a novel where Atlanta also features in it. And since moving to the States, I've written short stories where they're also set in the States. And I think it's normal, right? That where you live influences what you write and how you write. Very often I write about people at the margins, that I love writing about, you know, especially women, you know, people at the margins, and the way that they are at the margins in Belgium is different from the way that they are the margins in the States, is different from the way that they are the margins in Nigeria. So for example, in my short story collection, Better Never Than Late, which came out, I want to say 2 years ago or 3 years ago, it's a collection of interlinked stories about the same group of immigrants, Nigerian immigrants in Belgium. And their experiences, because of the space that they are in, is completely different from the experiences of the Nigerian characters in the States, in the Middle Delta. Yeah.
What impact has teaching creative writing had on your writing?
Just, I've been teaching creative writing now for maybe 8 years. And I just sort of love walking into class and seeing all these, especially my undergrad class, and seeing all these really eager, keen, you know, young people eager to learn and wanting to write. And my classes are very writing intensive. And when I read these stories of, especially of these young writers who haven't learned any rules yet, so they're not scared to take risks, you know, it is so inspiring. It reminds me of how to write, right? Because if you don't know what to fear, then you're sort of fearless in your writing. And sometimes, you know, along the way, the more you write, the more you have to be intentional about being fearless. But if you have people who haven't learned any quote unquote rules about writing, there's a fearlessness to their writing that is so invigorating and is so, inspiring. So, yeah, so I do love teaching. And then my MFA students, I mean, their writing is a bit more, a bit more, for want of a better word, established. So it's also interesting to sort of read these works by writers who are writing things so different from what I'm used to writing, whose writing hasn't yet been influenced by what editors have told them, you know, or by many rejections, right? So there's an innocence to the writing that is very inspiring.
And you yourself write in different ways. So how do you think your writing routine differs when you're working on fiction as opposed to, say, your journalism? Or does it?
No. So I tend to work very early in the morning. So, and it's something I've done since I started writing seriously. So I'd wake up, 1 a.m., 2 a.m., and I'd work. And then I'd go back to bed. And if I'm writing a short story, I like to have a draft ready. So I like to start from the beginning to the end in one sitting. Otherwise, I find it very difficult to go back to that story. So I have a draft ready and then I go back to bed. And then over the following days or weeks or whatever, I can go back to the short story and continue working on it. But with a novel, it's completely different because it's a much longer form. So I give myself a certain number of words per day. So I'd wake up at 1 a.m. or whatever time it is, you know, do 1,000 words, and then I'll go back to bed, you know. And I try to do that every single day, you know, so that if I were to start a novel today, you know, I want to have the draft ready. I want to do that in 60 days. Minus weekends, when I sort of give myself a break, that I have, you know, 60,000 words, and then I can go back when it's done and start, you know, editing. It's the editing that takes time. The editing takes like forever. It takes years, right? But once I have that draft ready, then I feel like I've achieved something. And then it doesn't matter how long the editing takes. I just sort of need to get that skeleton down, and then I can start building, adding flesh onto that skeleton.
So your new novel, The Middle Daughter, is a modern reimagining of the myth of Hades and Persephone within a Nigerian family. Yeah. The story charts the main character's journey from freedom to homecoming. And so what inspired this project for you?
Gee, so two things. The first one is the original myth of Hades and Persephone. And it always bothered me that in some retellings, Persephone almost accepts, you know, this abduction and accepts this travesty as a proper marriage, right? And it's never really articulated that Hades not only abducts her, but actually sexually assaults her, because that is what he does. The marriage isn't consensual, right? And so I wanted a retelling where the Persephone character would very actively fight against, you know, this quote unquote marriage, no matter how long it takes her to fight against it. I wanted where, you know, she would willingly come out herself as she would be able to build a life for herself. And then the second inspiration. So years ago, a friend of mine posted on Facebook the story of a schoolmate of hers who was sort of lured into a relationship by a man that she really, you know, he was her friend, and he claimed to be a quote unquote man of God, very much like Ephraim is in The Middle Daughter, and lured her into a relationship. And she didn't want the relationship, but she couldn't tell anybody because she was very worried about being judged. You know, he also sexually assaulted her. And coming from a society where if you're sexually assaulted as a woman, you're almost blamed for it, right? She couldn't tell anybody about that either. And I also wanted to write her story. And so it's sort of that intersection of the true story of this woman who now lives in Canada and Hades and Persephone.
Without giving too much of the plot away, I can say again that this does reimagine the story of Hades and Persephone with Nigerian characters. And Nani, the protagonist, goes through some really painful and difficult experiences, a true descent into hell. But what gives you hope as a reader moving through this process, this journey, is her strength as a character and her steadfast assertion of her own identity and refusal to just accept what's happening, even though she can't necessarily change everything that's happening. That's what sort of infuses the story with hope. So I wondered, how fully formed was Nani as a character in your mind as you embarked on the early stages of this writing process?
Yeah, it's going to sound corny, but when I'm writing, even if I have a fairly good idea of what the story is about, the characters sort of unfold themselves as I write. So Nani didn't come to me fully formed. I did know that I wanted a story with a happy ending, you know, and that I wanted a story where no matter what Nani suffered, that she was going to be able to not only survive it, but thrive. That was very important to me. There's a Nigerian academic, Nigerian scholar called Obioma Nnaemeka. And many years ago, she came up with this idea of Nego feminism. And Nego feminism she describes as no ego feminism or negotiated feminism. And she says she sort of differentiates it from Western feminism in the sense that in Nego feminism, you're still working within the parameters of a patriarchy because you can't shake it. You know, you can't shake patriarchy off that easily, and you can't shake it that much, right? And so how do women who are living within a patriarchal society, how do they ascertain power, and how do they sort of gain their independence and practice their own feminism, right? And I wanted to I knew that Nani was going to come against the tension between her independence and her society. Does that make sense? Yeah. And so these are some of the things that I knew, but I didn't know how Nani was going to exactly do that. I knew she was going to have to rely on the support of other people. I knew that she wasn't going to do it alone, because one of the things that Nego feminism, according to Nnaemeka, one of its tenets is really that you don't do it alone. You know, you can't. There have to be others around you to amplify your voice. There have to be others around you to help you along the way. There have to be others around you to make sure that you succeed, but you can't do it on your own. So I also knew that Nani wasn't going to do it on her own. I knew that she was going to have people along the way. I just didn't know who those people were going to be until they made themselves known to me.
That's interesting, because the novel does shift in perspective between its major characters, including the antagonist, Ephraim. A character who manages to be at once deeply religious and also an awful person simultaneously. How easy or difficult was it to write in the voice of a man who is so twisted?
I absolutely loathe Ephraim. But one of the things I think that writing does, and which is something that we often attribute to reading alone, is empathy. Because if you're a writer, to be able to write believably, to be able to write truthfully, you have to be willing to let go of everything you think and everything you believe and actually put yourself in the shoes of somebody else. So I had to be able to write Ephraim without judging him at the moment of writing him. I gave myself permission. I mean, I judge him, right? I judge him as a reader, but I had to be intentional in not judging him as a writer. Otherwise, I would not have been able to write him at all, right? So maybe it comes with years of practice, right? Of writing you can't always write about people who think like you, who look like you, who believe like you do, right? My job as a writer is also to imagine people who are completely different from me, people who do not think at all like I do. And I wanted to be able to understand this man who could, on the one hand, you know, be deeply religious. I don't know whether he believes it or not, right? I don't know whether or not he's performing his religiosity. But on the one hand, this man who is deeply religious, but who is also really cruel to Nani, but also a good father to his children, right? So I wanted to, in writing him, I was also sort of trying to understand him, right? I've also personally always been fascinated by men who could be really terrible partners, but be really great fathers, right? Yeah.
Your use of two languages in the novel is also intriguing. How did you come to your decisions about how much of your original language to use, and why was it important for you to include those passages in the novel?
Yeah. And so one of the things about The Middle Daughter is that it's very polyphonic, right? And once I could imagine the characters, because it's, I mean, there are four different voices, right? There's Udodi's voice, which had to be completely different from Nani's voice, which also had to be completely different from Ugo's voice. I'm forgetting their names, which also had to be completely different from Ephraim's voice, right? And I had to be able to imagine and see each character as their own person and hear them and listen to them to be able to then transcribe their voices, right? I just didn't want four characters telling different stories from different points of views but sounding alike, because then they would all sound like me. None of these four sound like I do at all. So it was just being able to imagine the four characters differently, you know, and being willing to open my ears to them and letting them talk to me and actually hearing their voices. And so whenever I wrote, you know, Ephraim's, I could hear him. And sometimes, I mean, there were times I laughed at him and all his bombastic use of language, but he was an individual to me. Yeah.
Is the Igbo language something that needs to be protected or preserved in any way? Or do you feel that it's already prevalent or pervasive enough in literature?
I think everybody just writes. You know, every character finds their voice, and every writer finds the way to, or their way to transcribe their character. I don't know, I'm trying to think if I've read any novel by any African writer where they have any character that sounds exactly like Ephraim. I haven't, right? It's just something peculiar to Ephraim.
There are so many lines in this novel that are quite striking, but one that's particularly memorable is, "Whosoever's voice is heard is not dead." What do you most hope that readers will take away after following Nani on her journey to hell and back?
Jeez, I hope that first of all, they really enjoy the novel as a piece of art, right? And I hope that, I really have no idea beyond just that they enjoy it as a piece of art, because I think that different readers will come to it with different experiences and take away different things. I can only speak for myself, and what I took away from writing it, especially writing the relationship between Nani and her mother, is how love can be so complicated, right? Because her mother really does love her, right? She just maybe doesn't know how to show it all the time. And her mother also really does believe that she's a good person, right? And I sort of love that complication within the mother, you know, that complexity within the mother, who is also vulnerable in ways that Nani doesn't see, but in ways that, you know, Nani's sister sees and I could see because, you know, I wrote her, right? So just the ways that love can be messy, even, you know, love that seems as straightforward as the love between a mother and a daughter. You know, she's not abusive in any way. She's not, that the relationship isn't the, you wouldn't think of it as a toxic relationship, right? And yet, you know, Nani is unable to tell her things, right? Nani is unable to tell her things. Nani is unable to believe that her mother's love would be enough to save her in that society that sort of asks for girls to be a certain way, right? And asks for women to be a certain way. And I don't know if the mother would have been able to save her, because she's also a widow raising two girls and trying to make sure that everybody sees that, trying to make sure that she doesn't stumble, right? So yeah, just how complicated life can be, and how torture sometimes contributes to that complication.
Are you working on anything new currently? Any new material?
I'm always working on stuff, but yes. So what am I working on? I started a novel many years ago about the daughter of Oluwade Ikuyano, Augustavus Vassa, who was an African slave. And he later became an abolitionist and married an English woman, had two daughters, one died in childhood, one survived. And I've been trying since forever to write the novel of the surviving daughter. So like a reimagining of her life. But I've also been thinking, not really started, of writing a novel set around the Igbo landing of 1803. When some, I think about 75 Igbo slaves who were brought in, you know, they survived the Middle Passage, got into Savannah and were sold in Savannah and were going to be taken to, I don't remember where, and in Dunbar Creek, they took over the vessel and there was some sort of mutiny and they drowned the two white men. And then they walked to their death into the creek, because they would rather die than be slaves. And every time, you know, like everything about written about this Igbo landing talks about their suicide. And that really bothers me, because these people came from a culture where suicide was taboo. And so for them, they were not committing suicide. They were just going home. And I've been thinking of sort of reimagining it and writing a novel about it with a woman at the center. Because, you know, history says it was a high chief that led them. And we all assumed that that high chief was a man. So I want to write, you know, a novel where it's a woman who sort of is the high chief that leads them home. Anyway, yeah. I'm putting it out in the universe so that I'm held accountable and I can do it. And I will do it.
We will look forward to both of those. They sound like excellent stories. Would you like to read something from The Middle Daughter for our listeners?
Yeah, sure. So I'll just pick something at random. And I'm going to read a Nani chapter. So you hear Nani's voice. So in the excerpt I'm going to read, Nani's left a toxic relationship and she's, you know, sort of thinking of next steps. And she's talking to her sister, Ugo, who lives in Atlanta. "Tell me about Atlanta," I asked Ugo when we spoke again. I didn't want to talk about me, to rake over the past. I wanted to pretend that Ephraim did not exist. "In the summer, it gets so hot that they call it Hotlanta," Ugo said. "Atlanta so hot and so full of Nigerians that it was easy for Ugo to forget that she was abroad. It's just like living in Nigeria with no power cuts." Every week, she got an invite to a Nigerian celebration, graduation party, birthday party, anniversary, memorial, funeral, celebration of life parties for parents and grandparents who died in Nigeria, which Ugo went to with $50 sealed in an envelope as her contribution. The pharmacist at Ugo's local CVS was a Yoruba woman, Yinka. The nurse who saw her the day she rushed herself to the ER, thinking she was dying of appendicitis, was an Igbo man named CJ, who once he found out she was Igbo too, asked her if she was married. He was looking for a wife, he said. And although America was full of beautiful women, Mami Wata women who looked like Halle Berry and Beyonce, women any man would be proud to put up photos of on Facebook and show off at parties, finding a marriageable woman was torture. A marriageable woman, he said, had to be not only Black, but Igbo. It would break his mother's heart if he brought home a foreign woman. And he, despite their beauty, could not deal with Akata. These Black American women are nothing like our women, no, he told Ugo. They don't have the patience our women have. They are too intense and they can't stand pepper. Why marry a woman who can't stand a bit of spice? Ugo looked like she would make someone like him a really suitable wife, he said. Ugo lied and told him that she was already married. It freaked her out, she told me. Someone proposing to her just like that. How could he, after 2 hours, decide that he wanted to marry her? Crazy, she said over the phone, and I could imagine her shaking her head at the incredulity of it all. Who marries someone they hardly know? She asked over and over again, as if pressing me for an answer. I ignored the question and asked her if she missed home. She didn't answer immediately, and I knew she did not miss home, even when she said, a little. But I miss you. I wish we were all together. Ugo might miss me, but I was sure she did not miss home because there was a farmer's market where the antidote to homesickness was weighed out in pounds and ounces, packaged and sold. Plantain, guava as big as an adult fist and as sweet as mother's guava, yam, nido, even kerosene mango, can you believe it? She'd asked me. There is nothing to miss. The shop smells like a fish stand, but I don't mind it. It's like being planted right in the middle of a better market. I can close my eyes, inhale, and believe I'm back in Enugu. When she had a yearning for suya, she went to the store on Roswell Road, owned by a Nigerian, where the best suya ever was to be found. I wished I had never asked her about Atlanta. What was I expecting? That she would tell me that she and mother cried every day? That they thought of me every day? She hadn't even asked about my children. Yeah, I think I'll stop there.
Chika Unigwe, thank you so much for joining us today. The new novel is The Middle Daughter, and it will be released in April 2023. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us. Look for more episodes of All Right in Sin City wherever you listen to podcasts, or check out our website, allrightinsincity.com. For information and announcements of new podcasts, sign up to our email list or follow us on Facebook and Twitter.